Welcome to the Vancouver Island Music Fest podcast. I'm Dan McLennan, and this is Ronnie Cox.
From 7 to 7, every night of the week. Fixing trains in the roundhouse, I work on my feet. And I told my children, I hope the bed bugs don't bite. I got hobos sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. From Akron and Hinckley and Prairie du Chien, they are soldiers and lawyers, and I believe what they're saying. And I'll rouse them at 4 and they'll head down the line. My hobos sleep in the roundhouse tonight. Good night, my hobos, rest your vagabond heads. On your old knapsack pillow, in your gunny sack bed. For a few stolen hours, you'll be all right. My hobo's sleeping in the roundhouse tonight.
I, like millions of others, was introduced to Ronnie Cox through the movie Deliverance, but I was unaware that you were such an accomplished musician. Can you take us on your musical journey?
I can indeed. See, I grew up in New Mexico, a small little town called Portales, and I was actually calling square dances when I was 10 years old. My dad played for all the dances around. He was a guitar player. And most people don't realize this, but where I grew up in Portales in the late 50s and early 60s was a hotbed of recording. Norman Petty Studios were in Clovis, New Mexico, and that was actually where Buddy Holly cut Peggy Sue, and the Fireballs and Sugar Shack was cut there, Jimmy Bowen and Buddy Knox. There was a country artist named Charlie Phillips sang a song called Sugar Time. Sugar in the morning, sugar in the evening, sugar at supper time. That was cut there. So I was actually cutting records when I was in high school. Norman Petty saw a group I was with at an exchange assembly when I was in high school and hired us to sing backup on records. And then I had a rock and roll band back in those days. Get ready for this. Ron's Rockouts. I was playing music all while I was in high school and college. Then in college, I fell in love with folk music and then studied child ballads for years. At one time, I knew like 400 English and Irish ballads and then branched out into, I knew songs in 17 languages, none of which I spoke. I just learned them phonetically. So early in my career, even when I was struggling as an actor, I was also struggling as a musician. It's just that I got good enough to make it as an actor long before I got good enough to make it as a musician. Most people don't realize this, but when I was in Washington, D.C., I was playing at the Cellar Door, Mr. Henry's, and Roberta Flack and I started out together at Mr. Henry's. We didn't play together. He had two separate rooms, the upstairs and the downstairs. And I got my first film largely because I could play. My second big film was a film called Bound for Glory, the Woody Guthrie film. I picked and sang in that. And my first television series was a show called Apple's Way, and I picked and sang a song on that every week. So early in my career, everybody knew that I was this actor from New Mexico that also played music. But it's just I've had such success for the last 25 or 30 years, playing generally guys in suits and ties and men of authority, presidents, dictators of Mars, head of Beverly Hills Cops, you name it, head of the National Guard. So now when people see me with a guitar in my hand, it's kind of messes with their brain a little.
There is a place I know down in Mexico, high in the old Sierra Madres, where many an outlaw band from across the Rio Grande have found a haven, a whole valley highway. The danger rides with those who stray upon that secret hideaway, where death will surely welcome anyone within the law. But if a man must run from any lawman's gun, he'll find compadres in the old Sierra Madres. But if a man must run from any lawman's gun, he'll find compadres in the old Sierra Madres.
Don't get me wrong, Dan, I love acting, and I'm good at it, but I don't love it as much as the music, and I kept trying to figure out why that was, and I think I finally figured it out. With acting, no matter what kind it is, movies, television, plays, you name it, there is and always sort of must be that imaginary fourth wall between you and the audience. And with music, and especially the kind of music I do where I also tell stories, there is the possibility of a profound one-on-one sharing that can take place. And it's that sort of idea of sharing the music that I find is an opiate that is undeniable, and I find myself drawn more and more and more to that. And that's the reason in my shows I like for the audience to be as close as possible. I like to be able to see the audience. If it's a show where I like them to leave the house lights up, I like my shows always to feel like music felt when we were growing up as kids, playing with our family and friends in the living room or kitchen or on the front porch.
Now, you play folk-based music, but that covers an extremely wide range. Who are your influences?
Well, everybody. That's the thing. I mean, Jack Williams and Jonathan Bird and of the contemporary guys. But I am a seeker of really good songs that I think I can do some. So I'll do a jazz tune. I'll do a standard. I'll do a silly. I'll do a Randy Newman tune. There's not a single way that I will go, that you can go, that I won't go if I think I can do something with the song. We all struggle with the definition of folk music, and mine is, if I like it, it's folk.
You did an album of songs by Mickey Newberry, obviously an influence there.
Oh, absolutely. Mickey Newberry, for my money, was the great Texas songwriter. I don't know if you know this or not, but because Mickey also wrote all over the place, too. That's one of the influences that I have, is that Mickey was not afraid to go. At one time, back in the days, in the 60s, when we used to have charts, for this chart and that chart and this chart for music, Mickey once had five different songs on five different charts, and four of them were number one.
That's pretty impressive.
It is indeed.
Is there a favorite off of that album that really speaks, where Mickey really speaks to you?
Well, yeah, there are several. It's like picking a favorite child. I wouldn't say a favorite, but I can name several favorites. Obviously, Sweet Memories, because it was Mary's favorite song, and it's, I can't do a show without doing a song. And the thing I love about Sweet Memories is as far as I know, it's the only song I know that only has two words in the chorus. And what a brilliant chorus it is. And it was Willie Nelson's first number one hit, and Andy Williams had a number one hit on the pop charts with it, so it shows the sort of universal appeal of the song.
She slipped into the silence of my dreams last night, wandering from room to room. She's turning on each light. Her laughter feels like water from the river to the sea. I'm swept away from sadness, clinging to her memory.
I didn't start writing songs until I was in my early 50s, because being coming from acting and for years, I would do gigs, and I would do two-hour gigs and do nothing but Mickey Newberry tunes. But you pretty much can't go wrong if you're doing those. So I didn't feel a need to write any songs because I was doing some pretty killer songs.
Can we fast forward to the latest album, Ronnie Radd and Karen?
You bet. And you know, it's in some ways it's my favorite album. Radd and Karen, Radoslav Lorkovich, and who will be with me at the Vancouver Festival, and Karen Mall and I had been playing together for a number of years, and we knew all these songs cold. And what we did is I hired a studio. I phoned a wonderful bass player in town that I know, who had never heard the songs, by the way. And I got the studio, and we all met at the studio at noon, and we would play the song once for the bass player, and then we would record it. And 5.5 hours later, we walked out of the studio with 14 songs recorded. There's no overdubs. There's no going back. Are there mistakes on the album? Probably, but nothing that really bothers me. And it's an album that just does my heart good to hear it, because the music is just sort of real.
That's an incredible production. Are there tracks there that stand out for you?
Yeah, but here again, they were the songs that I do in my show, and so obviously there's Dadgummit, The Night John Houston Died. There's practically the whole album. I can't do an album without doing a song called Sanctuary. A lot of people think Sanctuary is my signature song. And I didn't write it. Two guys named Larry Bastian and Tom Bacci actually wrote the song, but I was the first one to record it.
What is it that, about that song that speaks to you?
Well, it's, you know, I grew up in New Mexico. And when I was a kid, I worked on a ranch and thought I knew everything there was to know about horses. And when I was doing research for when Larry was telling me about the sanctuary, what I found out was a little foal born in the wild only has 6 minutes to get up and get moving. Otherwise, you know, the predators come. So I always introduce the song by saying, imagine what it's like to be a mare, because the song is written in a way from the mare's point of view. And so imagine what it's like to be a mare that's just given birth to this little wobbly-legged guy, and it's cold and snowy, and there's predators all around, and she knows she has to get him to a safe place.
Morning breaks pretty on the canyon floor, a place she's been looking for. She tests the wind till she's sure it's sanctuary. There's a south side pocket where the rim rocks in dead. Cheekgrass water in the sun ascended. Lord, would you give them some time to spend in sanctuary? Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Where do you go with a brand new foal? Sanctuary. Sanctuary.
And, you know, it's one of the simplest songs in the world. It's got three chords. Harlan Howard used to say that a good song is three chords and the truth. Well, I think that Sanctuary qualifies on that level.
Now, you got to know John Houston quite well.
I did indeed. I got to play poker with John, and he was my hero in lots of ways. And I talked about it in my blog a bit. But I'd had a stormy relationship with my own father and had never really gotten in touch with those feelings. And oddly enough, by sort of transferring some of those to John, I was able to then revisit the feelings of my dad and realize how much I loved him and missed him, and was actually finally able to write a song about my father. And so John has meant a lot to me on lots of levels. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting here in my little log cabin. There is a portrait of John Houston right over my right shoulder.
He loves the game of poker. That's how I knew him best. By that time he was older. There was a cloud upon his chest. And if he won or lost, his expression never changed. John was a student of the game. He wasn't much of a husband. He was married to his work. There were millions who loved him, and a precious few he hurt. He was a man of visions who saw the world in frames. John was a master of the game. And I saw Sierra Madre when I was just a kid. Somehow I had to find out how he did the things he did. His red badge of courage, his African queen. He taught me about life, casting shadows on a screen.
Now, it was Deliverance that introduced you to most of us, opened an awful lot of doors for you. Is it possible to overstate the importance of that movie to your career and life path?
Probably not. Because I was a totally unknown, just barely struggling hand to mouth. My wife Mary was a PhD chemist in cancer research, and we were living that whole sort of graduate student struggling actor existence for a lot of years, and had two small boys, and I'd never made more than $6,000 in 1 year in my life, and so literally, I can't even describe how dramatically my life changed from that. So all of a sudden, from being just someone who didn't know really where our next meal was coming from, and lots, certainly nothing down the road, to all of a sudden being offered, just being offered jobs, jobs that I didn't even know existed before were being offered to me, and not that I started making tons of money, I didn't, but in terms of what I had been making before, it seemed like tons. And so in many ways, everything that's happened in my career since, it was a direct result of that remarkable film. And I don't know if you know, last year, 2012, was the 40th anniversary of us having made Deliverance.
Indeed.
And I've just written a book on the making of Deliverance called Deliverance, the Dueling Badges, The Deliverance of Truth. And I'm really quite pleased with it, although I have to tell you right now, Dan, that the book has no literary pretensions. I mean, I didn't want it to be any sort of literary book. I wanted it, since I am a storyteller, I wanted it to feel as though you and I were sitting having a cup of coffee and I was just telling you the stories.
It has that feel to it. There's lots of great stories in it. And having read it, I kind of found myself wondering how the four of you guys survived that movie.
Well, in retrospect, and I've talked to John Boorman and to the other guys about this a lot, we did things we probably shouldn't have done, and it's a miracle that one of us didn't die. I almost drowned once. Ned almost drowned once. John Boorman had stated years ago that he felt that he didn't like to use stuntmen because he felt that any shot that required a stuntman probably shouldn't be shot, and so that was his philosophy. But having now later, he said now he's changed. I said in retrospect, he's gone back and his nightmare is that one of us didn't die because we really went through some harrowing stuff.
So are you sick of hearing Dueling Banjos by now?
You know, not really, because that song is just so infectious you know, most people do it in some sort of corrupted way, and so I have to admit that occasionally when we do it in my show, we don't really do. First of all, I don't have a banjo in my band, and so until you've done Dueling Banjos with an accordion, then you haven't lived.
You spend an awful lot of time on the road, as far as I can see, looking at your tour schedule. How is it that you're making your way out to the Vancouver Island Music Fest? How did that come about?
Well, Doug Cox, who is a good friend, and he and I have been running into each other for years and at folk festivals and stuff, I've been bugging him and saying, come on, get me into there. And it's funny because, you know, for years I worked in Vancouver because when I was doing on the Stargate and I must have the last, oh, the 10 or 12, yeah, I was working in Vancouver so much that I actually would get work permits by the year. and I actually had an apartment there, but I had never played music in Canada. So I finally got Doug to book me into the festival, and I'm delighted. And I'm coming this year with Radoslav Vorkovich and Chojo Jacques, two wonderful players, and we're really looking forward to it.
Ronnie Cox bringing his music and storytelling talents to the Vancouver Island Music Fest this year. So much of what makes the Vancouver Island Music Fest so special comes from all the work that's done by volunteers before the performers take the stage. James Lithgow is a good example. He's the Music Fest piano tuner. He likes to work on the pianos early in the morning, well before the music starts, but he also enjoys working with the musicians to help them get the sound they're looking for.
For a pianist who sits and, you know, who spends hours and hours getting good enough to perform in public, they get to know their instrument pretty well, but they don't always know the technical aspects of it because it's reasonably complicated inside sometimes, and they like to, you know, if the touch is a little heavy or something like that, they might ask if there's anything you can do there, or sometimes the way they play will cause a note not to fire the same way, so you need to make adjustments. But generally speaking, though, the pianos that we get at Music Fest are seen by a lot of technicians, and good technicians too, doing good work. So they arrive to me in very good condition, generally speaking. There's very little to do other than to tune it and just make sure that nothing falls off, no case parts fall off, you know, make sure all the little catches are in place.
It sounds like work that brings you a good deal of satisfaction.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting work. I know it's hard. A lot of people, they go, it's like watching paint dry, but it's in the details.
What is it about the detail that appeals to you?
Oh, well, the way sound behaves, I guess. The piano produces beautiful sounds. And just the way sound behaves as you move pitches around and what's acceptable to the ear and what the ear doesn't like and why the ear doesn't like certain things. And how we all hear a little differently. For players at home, you know, they sort of go in and out of tune with their piano, but a performer is going around playing a lot of different pianos that are well tuned, generally speaking, well tuned and looked after. So they get to know quite well what they want a piano to do. Whereas for a great many people, their home piano is the only piano they ever play, and you know, you sort of go out of tune with it. You go out of condition in the same way that the instrument might go out of condition. You don't notice it. It happens so gradually.
Music Fest piano tuner James Lithgow. And that wraps up another Vancouver Island Music Fest podcast. Thanks for listening. And thanks to Helen Austin and Todd Butler for wrapping up another one.
We can sit together and watch the show. Here at Vancouver Island Music Fest. Here at Vancouver Island Music Fest.
here at Vancouver Island Music Fest.